Elizabeth Barrett is a wife, mother, grandmother, licensed marriage and family therapist, educator, eavesdropper, and emotion worker. She uses all of these skills to address the subjects we all struggle with in this conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. Hi, Elizabeth. Happy Tuesday.
Happy Tuesday, Hank. And today is one of those days that we'll be talking about something that I think many people grapple with and don't talk about at all. So, although I don't know if I can say I'm looking forward to today's conversation, but I think it's a necessary conversation. But before I get started, I want to know how you're doing.
I'm doing just fine, thank you.
I'm good. You look glorious today.
Oh, thank you. I'm staying here where it's a cool 70 degrees in the studio.
Yeah, absolutely.
Instead of outside where I just heard it was 108.
Well, it was interesting because people were looking at me funny as I walked toward the studio in my long sleeve shirt and long pants. Because it is chilly.
It's always freezing in here.
Keeps us alert.
Yep.
But it's good to see you today.
You too. You look glorious as well.
Thank you. Feeling glorious and ready to work. Because today we're going to talk about Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. It's a tough topic that I avoided clearly all month because it's the last Tuesday of this month. And I kept putting it off because I wasn't sure how to approach it. It's depressing to talk about. It's frightening to talk about suicide. It's overwhelming to say the word out loud. It's a very dark, secretive, shameful part of our society that only sees the light of day in tragedy because we only talk about suicide in the face of tragedy, when a young person has taken their life or an elderly person has taken their life or anyone has felt so desperate and so alone that they choose to take their own life. And so we never really talk about the genesis of suicide or where it comes from or how to cope with loss after suicide. And so I've avoided this subject, I'll be honest. I kept pushing it aside all month, and then I kept seeing it on my calendar, and I thought, oh, but there's other things. I don't want people to be turned off by the conversation. I want to hear, you know, radios clicking off all over the place because it's not something people want to hear about. But the mere fact that you're feeling like you want to turn off your radio or go away right now means that we need to have this conversation. Because one of the things that we know most about mental health and well-being is that it is the secrets that we keep, the thoughts we refuse to have, or the beliefs that we refuse to share. It's those secretive things that live in our psyche that make us sick. Those are the things that make us withdraw, that keep us from connecting to others, that make us feel alone. And so when there's something that we want to recoil from, something like the conversation about suicide, that means that it's someplace we probably need to go. And not that we're going to get to a place where we feel comfortable or change our attitude or become accepting, right? It's not one of those things where you all of a sudden gain some clarity and you say, oh, I get that now. Everything's fine. Because it's not all fine. Because suicide is not all fine for the person attempting to or successfully taking their life, to the 100 survivors that are left behind with every suicide. Its average is 100 survivors who are left behind with every one suicide. So I would imagine that we've all been touched in some way by suicide, either within our own family or within our friend group or even in our society, our community. You know, a lot of people are grieving the loss of professional baseball player Jose Fernandez over the weekend, and I was reading the article today because I wanted to skip reading what I was about suicide, and I needed a little break, and I ended up reading the article about his death, and he ended up crashing his boat into a jetty. But reading the story, you have to wonder, did he go off on a suicide mission that night with his friends? Was he that upset? And so, you know, for the amount of suicides that we know, because people leave notes or the intention is there, there are a lot of suicides that happen that are never classified suicide because it's not clear what happened. The point is, there's a lot of people hurting all the time, all the time. And by not being able to talk about what's underlying our emotional lives or our feelings, we get deeper into the dark, or our family members get deeper into the dark. And the deeper into the dark we go, the harder it is to reach out and ask for help or to look for help. So I'm hoping you'll stay with me today. I'm hoping you'll hang with this conversation. And I most hope that you'll feel inspired or compelled to call in and talk about this subject with me, so that I'm not alone in this conversation, so that I know that you understand that when we tell our stories and we share our experiences, we help so many other people that we'll never meet. That just the mere exercise of talking about an experience you had will touch so many people. And so I'm hoping that this conversation is not a conversation of one, a monologue of one, that you'll find the courage to call in and talk about the subject also. Before we get started, I do want to give you a phone number, though, in case today's conversation triggers something in you that makes you feel uncomfortable, frightened, suicidal, to please make that phone call to the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. That number is 1-800-273-TALK, 1-800-273-8255. That's the National Suicide Prevention Hotline. I also have other local numbers here that are available in the studio. And if you want to call in, Bree will be happy to give you those numbers. Our number is 805-781-3875. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And you can be part of the conversation by calling in. You can also join us on our Facebook page, The Reluctant Therapist, where we update shows on a weekly basis, post pictures. You can leave comments. You can also send me an email to elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com and follow us on Instagram @thereluctanttherapist. And you can listen to previous shows by visiting kcbx.org, our wonderful website. Look under the News Talk tab, and we're right at the top there. And all of the shows from the last 3 years, 4 years are there for you to listen to. And you can also subscribe to our podcast through iTunes. Go to iTunes, plug in A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist, and you'll have the opportunity to subscribe, and you can listen at any time. So, as I said at the top, today's show is in honor of Suicide Prevention Awareness Month. And as I said, I've avoided it all month. It felt overwhelming. I feel really anxious knowing where to go with this, because I don't want to trigger others who might be feeling suicidal or feeling hopeless or feeling overwhelmed, because the fear is if we talk about it, other people will act upon it. And even though I know professionally that that's not true, that connection really isn't true, that actually when we talk about things, we're less likely to act on them, it still has that energy inside of me that I fear that I'm going to send someone the wrong direction. So that made me keep avoiding it. And then, of course, I had planned to do this show, and then my guest canceled because he didn't want to talk about this subject. And so I thought, well, here I am, and here we are, because we need to talk about suicide, because it's at the highest rate. Suicides are at their highest rate in the last 30 years. And the thing that was so distressing to read that statistic, that we're at the highest rate, and that's across all demographics, adolescents, those of middle age, and those of old age. They're up in all categories. But the part that was really distressing were some of the reasons for these increased suicides, and this was primarily in those in middle age. And even though men are more likely to commit suicide than women, we're seeing a rise in middle-aged women's suicide rates. And some of the reasons that we found is that one is the economy, that people are overwhelmed and feel like they can't crawl out from under debt or crawl out from under mortgage payments, or get a handle on their financial lives. The downturn in 07, 08 has been really challenging to overcome for a lot of people. So the economy is one thing that is leading to these higher rates of suicide. Also addiction, and primarily opiate addiction. Even more than drug and alcohol abuse, we're seeing opiate addiction leading to high rates of suicide and suicide attempts in women. Loneliness, For all of our technological connections, we're an incredibly lonely culture. People feel isolated. You know, a text message is a wonderful way to check in, but it doesn't replace a physical touch, a hug, a handhold, looking someone in the eye. And so although we feel like we're more technologically connected, we're lonelier than ever before. And climate change. Well, on a day like today when it's 108, you know, it's frightening. People feel overwhelmed. They feel like they can't make change or change won't happen. And so because of that hopelessness, that overwhelm, they're making the choice to take their lives. So these things, and along with other things, lost relationships, grief, transitions, health problems are, you know, a big risk factor. All of these things play into the suicidal ideations that lead people to make an attempt. And that triggers, you know, having this overwhelm of the economy and addiction and loneliness and struggling with relationships and the fear of climate change or, you know, habitat destruction. It triggers depression, and it can lead to major depressive disorders and a sense of hopelessness. So knowing that suicide is on the rise, and knowing that there are factors here that a lot of people are concerned about, how can we bring these feelings out into the open so that people don't feel so alone with their fears or their overwhelm about feeling like a failure because they can't keep up with their payments, or feeling like a failure because they started taking opiates because of pain management and now they're addicted, feeling the failure and loneliness of having failed relationships. I want to talk about this because suicide has touched my family in profound ways. The first time was when I was a freshman in college, and I had come back for Christmas vacation from my freshman year, first fall quarter, and I didn't want to go back to school because it was too much, and I didn't feel like I was ready for college. And on New Year's Day, my uncle committed suicide. And at that moment, of course, as you can imagine, it threw our family upside down. And so my parents said, you need to go back to school because we can't deal with you right now. We need to work with our family and support relatives, aunts, uncles, my grandmother. And so I went back to school, and it was interesting because the fallout after that was how we talked about my uncle's suicide. You know, within my family, my parents told me what had happened, but to the outside world, he was sick or had a heart attack, or, you know, my grandmother didn't want the story to be told because there's so much shame and embarrassment on the family when you have a suicide within the family. And so at that moment, I kind of incorporated or took in that idea that I don't want other people to know that my family was weak or my family was somehow broken, and that my uncle felt like there was no one in our family he could talk to, and so he took his own life. And last year, my cousin committed suicide. She was my age. We'd grown up together. We had very, very different trajectories in our adult life, and she struggled with eating disorders and depression and a myriad of things that I'm sure I'll never know, and she took her own life. I wonder if she found peace in that. I wonder if, you know, that was the only option she felt she had. And again, that shame and concern within the family to want to make it go away or not be the story of our family. And having those experiences in my family, knowing that the first response is to kind of keep it secret, to not want other people to know the whole story, one, doesn't help other people who might be struggling with feelings of suicidal ideation. And two, it doesn't tell the truth about what was going on in my uncle's life or my cousin's life. You know, what were the things that led to my uncle's suicide? It wasn't just because he woke up one day and that was it. Here's a man who had struggled with alcoholism for years and went in for help and was prescribed antidepressants. And the antidepressant side effect is suicidal ideation. And he had no outlet and nowhere to turn, and that's where he went. And so we don't understand the whole story when we just bury that experience of suicide. So today I'm open to sharing my story and my feelings, the experiences I've had growing up, you know, from the time I was young into my adult life, the feelings I've had where I've thought about suicide, had that notion or that idea that the pain in my life at this time, whatever it was, through loss or grief or transitions or body image, all the things that I've maybe struggled with at different times in my life, and I've had that thought that this would be the easy way to go and I just can't keep going this way, that I know I'm not the only one, that I know suicidal thoughts are very, very common, and yet we don't want to say it out loud because we might sound weak. So today's our chance to share these stories. And I'm wondering what your story is. And what does it take to make your life worth living on a daily basis? How do you get up and keep doing this when we do have things that are overwhelming and hard to live with? 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of this conversation. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. And we'll start with Bill. You're on the air. Bill, what's on your mind?
Hi, Elizabeth. Hi. Yeah, I felt obliged to call you. I'm the guest that you referred to.
And I wasn't throwing you under the bridge.
I told I was going to be on the show. And I thought we were going to be talking about another disagreeable subject, which is disability. And I don't know anything about suicide or suicide prevention, except from the context of some movies that have been made about disabled people who have been who have killed themselves or wanted to kill themselves because they were disabled. And that idea kind of sticks in my craw because I know so many people who are disabled who have not killed themselves and have gone on to lead pretty productive lives. And, you know, hopefully maybe some of them will call you up and tell them how they managed to do that.
Mm-hmm. Well, because I would imagine that when anything traumatic happens or life-altering happens, whether it's, you know, ending up with a disability or a chronic health problem, that there are moments through the recovery period where suicide feels like a viable option, and it's a very critical time for needing support and a vision of what life can be post this tragedy.
Yeah.
Well, Bill,
But the movies seem to encourage people mm-hmm. that's the only option. That especially this newest movie that came out, one called Me Before You, mm-hmm. this guy gets hurt and he gives himself 6 months to live and he goes through it. And, you know, and that's a best-selling book and a popular movie. You know, and to me, that's insulting.
Mm-hmm. Well, and you and I had talked about it briefly, you know, because part of it is, you know, novel that there was a love story involved. I mean, I don't think it was an accurate depiction, but I think what your point is, that why someone in a wheelchair was only given himself 6 months to recover as if that was no alternative to the life he had before. And I think, again, those are why we have to have these conversations about with people who are going through traumatic changes in their life to make sure we're addressing the suicidal ideation and to help them kind of dig their way out of this dark place into a new space.
Well, if the media were to portray us in any other way, that would help people understand that there is life after a wheelchair. And, you know, the media just tries to brush us under the carpet and pretend we don't exist and gives people very, very few other options of what to do with their lives.
And I think that's a point well taken, Bill, and it is a conversation we are going to have soon. But your point of what the media thinks is appropriate to share is true across all factors. The media doesn't want to talk about suicide. It doesn't want to talk about anything that's disagreeable or anything that's uncomfortable in really honest ways other than kind of salacious stories that kind of catch your attention. But Bill, thank you for calling in. I look forward to having the conversation about disabilities and how the media portrays or how people interact. 805-781-3875 is the number to be part of this conversation. And you're on the air. What's on your mind today? Hi, are you there?
Renee?
Hi. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hi there, you're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there. What's on your mind today?
Hello?
Hi. I don't know if you can hear me.
I'm just having a bad connection. I was just concerned with what's happening at the Atascadero State Hospital. We've in the last month had two suicides, and one of them was a murder of a woman and her baby, and then he killed himself. And they tell the people out there, don't talk about it, don't let anybody know. And, well, you know, they're traumatized, and it's a hard job to begin with. And, you know, this is a regular occurrence.
And are you... Are the employees being told not to talk about it? Is that the concern? Is that there's no place for the employees to share what their experience is?
Well, maybe privately, with, you know, but it's controlled. You know, they're instructed by management to not tell people, and it's very traumatic. You know, if somebody doesn't show up for work and they're dead, or they've killed their spouse, their pregnant spouse, and then themselves. But it's, you know, we've had two of these in the last month. And, you know, I myself have suicides in my family, my great-grandmother and my cousin. You know, it is a very hush-hush. You know, most people want to portray it as, you accurately portrayed it at the beginning of the show where you said that people want to pretend it's something else.
Mm-hmm.
But these things will affect people for the rest of their lives.
And so how do we handle it differently? How do you think it would be, what would be helpful?
I think, like, you know, what they've worked on doing with alcoholism is like this, it's still a stigma, but, you know, more and more people face that it's a disease. It's not that an alcoholic is a bad person.
Mm-hmm.
It's that they have a disease. So with suicide, that's not a disease. That comes from depression, hopelessness. We shouldn't shame people. We should make it more like, get help, let's get you out. You know, open. I love what you said about hurting. They're hurting.
And I appreciate you calling in. Our line's a little rough, so I'm going to let you go. But we'll continue this line of thought about hurting. You know, oftentimes when people have had a suicide attempt and they talk about it afterwards, they'll often say, I didn't want to die myself, but I wanted the pain of my life as it is to die. I wanted my life as it was in that moment to die so that I could have a do-over or something different could emerge. And so to have a forum to be able to talk about that without people turning away, because the minute we say, I feel like killing myself, or I feel suicidal, or I feel there's nothing to live for, people feel frightened hearing that. And they'll say, don't think that way. Or you've got so much going on. You have a family. You've got a career. You have all these things. Don't feel that way. And as soon as someone hears don't feel that way, they know they can't talk to that person anymore because they're not okay to hear it. And so I think part of the challenge is, how do we become okay hearing someone say to us, our child say to us, our spouse say to us, our parents say to us, I don't feel like being here anymore. I don't feel like I can continue on. How can we hear that statement and not panic? How can we hold that space and have the conversation? Because that, to me, in many ways, is the bridge. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. This is A Conversation with a Reluctant Therapist. And Sarah, you're on the air. Oh, I'm sorry, Mary, you're on the air. What's on your mind today?
Oh, hi. Hi, Elizabeth. I know you. We were in a big group together at one time. Mm-hmm. And you possibly know my daughter. But anyway, 3 weeks ago, she wrote a suicide note to her husband, and her husband and two friends and the administrator at the the school where she teaches, they put her into a hospital. And so she was in the hospital for 8 days, and then they let her out, and they put her in a program for 8 weeks where she attends classes from 9 to 3, Monday through Friday, and she can go home on the evenings and on weekends now. But it has turned our lives kind of upside down. It's a horrible thing to think about. We didn't know what to do, so we went and talked to our minister, and he referred us to Transitions Mental Health.
Mm-hmm.
And then from there, we learned about NAMI, which is the National Alliance for Mental Illness.
Mm-hmm.
And we've been going to classes at NAMI and at Transitions. I've taken like 8 different therapy groups just in the past 2 weeks just to try and understand what my daughter's going through, mm-hmm. and to understand what other families are going through.
Mm-hmm.
And it is so prevalent. I mean, there's so much mental illness in these families. It just blows my mind.
Mm-hmm.
it's everywhere. And you just don't realize it until you start going to support groups and you realize, oh, God, you know, these terrible illnesses can happen. Mm-hmm. And my daughter suffers from major depression. Mm-hmm. And other families just have bipolar and just all kinds of extreme mental illnesses. So anyway, I just wanted to tell you thank you for talking about this because we didn't expect it to be part of our family, and it is.
And Mary, how are you doing right now?
Well, I'm nervous to be talking on the phone with you, for one thing. Mm-hmm. But I do want you to know that I listen to your show every week, and I want to call in all the time, but I'm always afraid to call in. So I feel nervous about that. But aside from the mental illness, I'm feeling better that my daughter is getting the help by being in these classes. And she tells me that she's really trying to put practice, you know, to practice what she's learning, mm-hmm. to really make some effort to change her life or change the way she looks at life. Because she's so sad, and she doesn't know why. Mm-hmm. And she doesn't have any reason to be. Like, you know, she's employed. Her husband's employed. They bought a little house in San Jose. Everything's looking good, but she just has this fog that comes over her, and it descends, and it does something to her. It takes all the joy out of her life. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. I'm just trying to attend these classes and learn what I can about suicide and to see if there's a way that we can get through it, my husband and I and our families, and to be with other families and be able to help them if we can.
Absolutely. Mary, I'm proud of you. You did great today on the phone.
Oh, thanks. I don't know why I'm so nervous, but
no,
I am.
Everybody gets nervous when they call in, and it takes a lot of courage. But you sharing your story, I know, touched a lot of people. But do me a favor. Keep breathing.
Pardon?
Keep taking those nice, easy breaths.
Okay.
Fill your tummy. Fill your breath. And my thoughts will be with you.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Thanks for calling in. This is The Conversation with the Reluctant Therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And today we're talking about Suicide Prevention Awareness Month and that thing which we don't talk about, suicidal ideation and the suicidal thoughts that are common. Millions of people daily think about suicide. A small percentage of them act on it, and a smaller percentage are successful. But many millions of people have the thoughts daily, and we don't talk about it. So when your child comes to you and says that I'm sad or depressed, or your friend or your spouse, how do we respond to them? What's the healthiest, most meaningful way we can start this conversation so that we don't turn away someone who's struggling and suffering and have them go deeper into their sadness or depression or hopelessness? How can we open that space even when we're terrified of those feelings ourselves? You know, it's something we don't talk about because the fear is if I talk about suicide, if I talk about suicidal thoughts or depression, I'll somehow go to that dark space. It'll send me there. Or if I acknowledge that I have these suicidal feelings, it will send me over the edge and I'll do something about it. Or if I say to someone, you know, sometimes my life just feels too overwhelming, like I can't be here anymore. The fear is if we say that out loud, the people will look at us differently or that they will recoil from being with us. And they might, but you also might find that they'll say, gosh, I've had those feelings too. I've gone through periods where it's been so dark, I couldn't see my way out. And it's so challenging for families because no parent wants to hear that their child is so depressed that they are attempting to take their life or wanting to commit suicide, because then as parents, we feel like we failed in some way or that our family is not enough love or support for them in that way and that we failed. But what we need to recognize is that there's much more to what goes on in the psyche than just interactions with the family. Our life is about our interactions outside in the world or how we take in the environment around us or our own temperament, the lifestyle we're living, the nutrition we take in. And as much as I appreciate the idea that, you know, all suicide is associated with mental illness or severe mental illness, that's really not true. There are people that attempt suicide or commit suicide who would not be diagnosed with severe mental illness. In the moment of that suicide attempt, they would be mentally unbalanced or unstable or, you know, having a major depressive moment that would cause them to go there. But it doesn't mean that they had major mental illness issues leading up to it, because that keeps pushing that that false belief that I can't catch suicide because there's no mental illness in my life. But that's not true. Because anything like a major loss of a spouse or a child or a family member can have this natural grief that is so overwhelming in us that we want to take our own lives. That doesn't mean that we're mentally ill with a chronic disease. It means that our psyche can't deal with the gravity or the size of the emotions they're feeling at the time. So we really need to be able to talk about all the ways that we go through periods of darkness and sadness and not always just write it off as that only happens to the mentally ill, because that's not accurate. 805-781-3875 is our number. Sarah, thank you for waiting. What's on your mind today?
Hi, I guess I'm calling because I've struggled, embraced my different levels of darkness, and I'm seeing my brother struggling with it. And I've, you know, worked with populations, like just at-risk populations, and seeing that the difference between what you're saying, like that the mental illness side, and then just sometimes these levels of darkness that bring us to that space of ideation. Mm-hmm. I guess I'm struggling with my brother and seeing what is appears to me as a chemical imbalance, and it has run in our family. And my dad has cousins that have struggled. I have an uncle that really struggles, and see my brother. And our last kind of interaction was being able to share with him my own experience in deep levels of darkness, and him seeking answers from me that I don't have. I don't have answers for him. And one of the things he says was saying to me was like, I just don't know how, I just don't know when. And I felt like, and what I said to him was, you don't have to know. We don't have to have an answer to these feelings. And he said, I thought you knew everything, and got really upset with me and hung up. But I think that's what I want to ask is, you know, how can I best support somebody who really struggles from a space of, I don't want to be helped almost, or, you know, I need to have these very concrete answers to solve this mystery of darkness that I want to escape from.
Absolutely. And Sarah, I'm going to take you answer offline, but thank you for calling in, and I hope you can still hear me. The struggle here is that there are no easy answers and there are no concrete answers. And part of the whole challenge of life itself is that we have to have the fortitude and the resilience and the support to live through the darkest dark of night and know that that lighter day comes, or that we may never have answers to the most perplexing or painful things that we experience in our life, and to be able to come to some comfort with that. And I think, again, that goes back to the whole reluctant therapist piece, is that for the last 25 years, we've been telling people that they can actually just, you know, get healed and never have these feelings again, or never go into a dark space, or never feel grief or loss. And that's just not true either. You know, the fact remains that if you have the luck of living a long life, you also within that long life are going to experience a lot of dark and deeply painful things. And so our work as clinicians, our work as sisters and brothers and parents, is to sit and hold that space to hear the story and say, I don't have any answers, but I'll sit with you all night. I'll walk with you all day. I'll be here with you for as long as you need while you're moving through this space. But I don't have the answer that will fix it for you. All I can tell you is that I've been there and I've survived and I'm here to live another day. And I think that is the most helpful thing we can be doing, is to get honest about, to be honest about mental health and what we can actually expect from it. And many people will go through their whole life with a very different experience. They may never feel a suicidal thought. They may never feel overwhelmed. But for a great many people, that is their experience, that they have darker feelings that make their life challenging. So I hope that helps, and I hope that kind of brings the conversation further. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. You're listening to Public Radio KCBX. Today we are talking about suicide prevention awareness, and I do want to give the number again to the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline. If you're feeling triggered or you're feeling that you need to talk to someone or you have a family member that you need to talk about, and that number is 1-800-273-TALK. 1-800-273-8255. And my number is 805-781-3875. Coraline, you're on the air, and thank you for calling in. Are you
there?
You're
welcome.
So one of the things I was going to talk about, again, was some of the ways that we can help people to deal with suicide attempts, suicidal ideation. And I wanted to talk about how powerful group work is, that one of the problems with suicide is because we're so afraid to talk about it for fear that we're going to send someone over the edge, that it becomes kind of darker and more devastating. And so I was going to talk about the balanced treatment programs of San Luis Obispo that just opened in July that you, Coraline, are the program director of, and the group work that you're doing primarily with adolescents but also with adults. And I'm hoping you can talk a little bit about that and why is group work with people who have suicidal attempts or suicide attempts or ideation helpful?
Well, you know, I'm thinking about something. I think you talked about it or an earlier caller about how suicide is often a hope to kind of reset because things are just so awful and intolerable that it's a intention to just start over. But unfortunately, it's a permanent solution to a temporary problem. I think the power in group work is that there's release. I think part of what's so sad with suicide and really severe mental health challenges is that people haven't found their way of releasing. There's a lot of pain and suffering around us, in our families. We all know it, and those of us who cope are able to find a way to release it. Mm-hmm. If you can't find a way to release it, you're much more vulnerable. And I think group work provides that release. It's a group of peers that you're not emotionally invested in, but you feel safe because there's therapists that are keeping it safe and keeping it respectful and safe. Mm-hmm. So again, I think it's that release. What's going to be your release?
And so your program, Balanced Treatment Programs in San Luis Obispo, you're the program director and you're a marriage and family therapist. And you have groups of eight, right, that come in for 3 months of treatment. It's not necessarily just for suicide attempts, but for drug and alcohol abuse and mental health issues. And so what have you seen with the adolescents? Because you talk about feeling safe and also being with people that you're not vested in. Because I think quite often parents, you know, want so badly to help and they want to be able to talk to their teens, but teens are reluctant to share their thoughts and feelings because they know their parents can't handle hearing it or they feel like they have to edit themselves. And so what is that experience for you facilitating this group work with adolescents? What have you seen as being helpful or leading towards healing?
The parents really benefit from getting a lot of education. They don't often understand that if their kids are keeping things from them, it's not because they don't respect the parents or they don't think the parents can help. It's because they love the parents so much, mm-hmm. they're afraid of worrying them. Mm-hmm. They feel guilty. They are ashamed of how they're feeling, and they actually love their parents so much they don't want to hurt them. Mm-hmm. And so it's a lot of education. Also, in trying to convince parents that asking direct questions is not going to lead their kids to do this. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of how do we support the parents so they're not afraid to ask the questions, to engage in the conversations.
Right, to flat out ask their child, are you thinking about suicide, and being able to sit with and hear the answer their child gives them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that clients are not alone. You know, we talk a lot about that in our program because suicidal ideation is very common, and attempts are also common in this population. So that usually does help for parents to hear that you're in good company. Mm-hmm. Your child's not alone. We've seen this before. We're professionals. We're trained. We talk about suicide in our groups. We're not afraid of it. Mm-hmm. We're not afraid to talk about it.
Absolutely. And so, Corleen, if people are interested to find out more about Balance Treatment Programs, can you give the local number?
It's 548-2200.
Wonderful. Thank you for taking the time to call in.
You're welcome. Thanks, Elizabeth.
805-781-3875 is our number today. And I don't have a name, so I'll just say anonymous. You're on the air. What's on your mind today?
Hi.
Hi there.
I wanted to call and kind of share what I think is a success story kind of in progress.
Okay.
I recently had a friend who told me pretty upfront about their suicidal tendencies. And my reaction was to listen and be kind of okay with that. And I adore this person. So in my mind, someone who's one of the most perfect people I've ever met. And I really want to invest in this person and the fact that they have this illness or this issue with depression, to me, doesn't matter. It's something I want to help them with, and I can be there for them because we all have something we're dealing with. And what makes this so different? What makes this such a big deal, you know? And so I've just developed a relationship with this individual where they feel they can trust me, and I tell them I want them to feel safe. And we just have an open dialogue on an ongoing basis where I kind of ask them how they're doing on a day-to-day basis, and we talk about it. And there's something that I've learned about suicide, and that it's not selfish. Mm-hmm. And it's usually about other issues. This person is very concerned about climate change and environmental issues that bring them down and, you know, make them worry about the state of the world more so than themselves. Mm-hmm. And we work through that, and I'm okay with where they're at. And one of the things they said to me was, I just need to know that if someday, you know, you're not going to just ask me to confirm that I won't do it or to just give you some kind of certainty, because I can't. And I said, you know, I get it. You know, let's just see what happens. And I'm here for you, and I believe in you, and I'm here for you.
That's a huge commitment you've made to another person. That's a wonderful commitment. And I think that's part of the story that I want to share today, that it doesn't take magic. You don't have to be a trained professional to sit with someone who's going through a dark period in their life, but we need to sit with them. And I thank you for taking the time to call, because I think that a lot of people, if they knew that just their presence and their willingness to listen would be helpful to another, would give people the courage to reach out and say, hey, you look like you're struggling. What's going on with you right now? How can I help? I can't fix it, but I can be here for you. And I think that's, again, part of this message of today, that we have to talk about suicide. We have to talk about, we have to notice and look at other people. We have to see what's going on with them, and to also understand that we may not be able to prevent their suicide. And I think that's the other difficult part of this conversation, is that no matter what we do, we may not be able to stop someone from taking their own life. That at some point, they may have a stronger compulsion to end their life or their suffering as they see it, then we'll be able to deal with and to be able to sit with that also. If someone we've cared for and loved takes their life, to be able to deal with the feelings of guilt or confusion or abandonment when someone takes their life. And I think that's a whole nother conversation, is, you know, is there a time where suicide is okay? And can we ever find a way to be okay with that? I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And Susan, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
Oh, yeah. With the new law that got passed, I think it was just last year, that says you can do suicide with your own, at your own hand. Mm-hmm. And people with disabilities were really against this, because we felt that there were a lot of people that would be euthanized without their real consent, or, you know. And there was a young girl with spinal muscular atrophy. She was on Facebook, and she decided to end her life. She was about 14. And a lot of people were upset about that. But one of the two of the people I know in the disability community who were very good advocates apparently also took their life because they had terrible pain. Mm-hmm. So it's like, okay, it's a real conundrum because you don't really want people to do that. But it was their choice, and they've been living with their pain for a long time. So it's a very individual thing. But the legalizing of it was really problematic for most people with disabilities because when a child is born with a disability, a lot of times the doctors will say, well, just put them in an institution because they're just going to be a vegetable. But there are a lot of people out there who survive and thrive with a disability, even if it's severe, because their parents and their families, they support them. So we don't want people to just automatically say, oh, just shove them in the institution or let them die or help them die. So it's really a very fine line that you're walking on.
It is. And I appreciate you calling in and bringing that piece up, Susan, because one, we have to have the conversation. Two, we have to not fear the choice that people make if they choose to end their own life. And then, of course, there is that fine line. Like, what age, then, is it okay to make that decision? We clearly don't want an adolescent making that decision because we know by developmentally, they're impulsive. They don't understand the concept of forever. So we absolutely would not want to allow a teen. We want to do everything we can to prevent a teen suicide. But then if someone's 50, 60, 70 years old and have lived with pain for years and years, is it changed then? I mean, I think, again, that's a whole other conversation. And today I really want to focus on having the conversation about suicide, just being able to talk about it without shame, or families who've had suicides in their family to be able to share that story, or if we've had suicidal ideations to be able to talk about it. Because again, it's those things that we keep secret inside that make us feel alone and isolated and different. And once we say out loud how we're feeling and recognize that there are people all around us feeling that way every day, it can change the energy of those suicidal feelings that can be overwhelming. You know, one of the things about saying it out loud and realizing we're not alone is that you can actually build closer relationships with other people once you admit to things that feel scary. And quite often we assume that we aren't lovable if we have things about us that are scary or dark or unattractive. And so we hold those things back to keep love in our life. But what it does is push people farther away or keep them outside of our life because they never really know what goes on inside of us. And if we have the courage to say, hey, here are the things that go on inside of me, and I hope you can still sit with that, can open a level of intimacy in relationships. It's incredibly, incredibly profound. Greg, you're on the air. What's on your mind today?
Hi. Yes, my name is Greg, and I just wanted to share a couple of resources. One is, I know there's a lot of apprehension talking, particularly to teens. As you know, it's the fifth leading cause of death for teens, suicide can be. And the Mayo Clinic has an incredible video of teens talking about suicide in a very powerful way. I worked at Atascadero State Hospital. I know your first person you talked with, or second, was there too. And I remember a night that I was sitting in front of my home and being told as an administrator that within 2 weeks a second patient had suicided. And it made me realize I was at kind of a fight or flight response, and I decided to learn everything I could, as much as I could, about suicide. The education piece is so important, so I compliment you for having this conversation. For example, the mention of the employee talking about suicide death at Atascadero of one of the employees. You know, when Robin Williams completed the suicide, there was real concern about how people would respond, you know, who had idolized and who loved him, and whether or not we would have copycats. And so, I mean, I think that this is the point of having communication with people all the time and keeping this not a hush type of subject, but something that someone feels comfortable talking about, can recognize symptoms. Even the way we've talked about suicide, we've used the word as committed suicide as if it was an offense. Mm-hmm. And the current language is a completed suicide, which is different, and it kind of doesn't make it feel as if one had done something wrong, I guess it might be the language of it. But I just wanted to share the other resource, of course, is the California Strategic Plan for Suicide. Mm-hmm. And these are great documents for people to educate themselves. And I'm still learning. I decided to attend the American Association of Suicidology Conference. There's great interventions now that are available, medications such as lithium that's proven efficacy. And so these are just things. And the good news is I think we're making progress, although the suicides continue. There's no question.
They do.
I just wanted to share those resources. If I don't know if you have any questions for me, but I know that one lady who said, you know, we can't talk about it. Sometimes there are issues that, you know, you can talk among peers, but sometimes they do have debriefing at the hospital, and sometimes they don't, maybe on that particular event.
Greg, thank you for taking the time to call. And it is true, you know, it's interesting that the conversation from Atascadero Mental Hospital came up right at the beginning, because it is important for employers to provide resources. We have mental health resources, but if there's a suicide or a death within a school or within a place of employment, to find that safe space so people can talk about it. And it's interesting because we don't generally, you know, have a space for employers to talk about suicides. And then that does start to trigger people. And I'm glad you brought up Robin Williams, because that his death, his suicide, did trigger a lot of people who had felt depressive feelings themselves, and they couldn't believe someone who seemed to have it all, right, who seemed to have everything they'd ever want, would take their own life. But that actually brought out a much bigger conversation that I think is so important, is that quite often, and we never know what's going on in someone's life. We can be living with someone and not really know what's going on in their life. But from the outside, you can never know. Someone might have the greatest job and be very good looking and have a wonderful spouse and wonderful kids and attempt to take their own life, or take their own life. And everyone will be frozen and say, if they're not happy, how could I possibly be happy, right? That we look inside of these people's lives, or we look from the outside and we assume that they have it all and they've taken their life, that somehow, you know, we must be broken in greater levels if someone that happy isn't okay. But I think really what it's a testament to is how narrow our definition of success is in the American culture, and following this American dream that we think when we get to a certain place, if we have all these things we've been told will make us happy, that our lives will be complete. But what happens more often than not, that people drive themselves to complete the American dream or this picture, and they still have never dealt with those underlying dark feelings of depression or loss or grief or whatever has driven them. And if we don't deal with those underlying feelings, then that suicidal ideation doesn't go away. It doesn't have a place for release, as Coraline was saying earlier. 805-781-3875. This is a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I'm Elizabeth Barrett. And Mark, you're on the air. What's on your mind?
I had an incident earlier in this year. And I guess I should preface it by saying that I'm the strong person. I'm the one that everybody leans on. I'm the one with the answers. But it was not long after Christmas, and it was sort of a perfect storm of stress combined with a prescription drug that just set this chemical storm up in my head. And next thing I know, I'm sitting there, and I just couldn't see any way ahead. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I'm the sort of person that says, you know, everything's temporary. The one caller mentioned, you know, it's a permanent solution to a temporary problem. Mm-hmm. So everything in my mind that was looking at it logically knew, and yet I couldn't see the way forward. Mm-hmm. And I would say, you know, there were some comments regarding adolescence. And what really led up to it was this, I would call it a stifling of my voice, in that I was feeling things, and in the midst of what was going on, I wasn't being heard. And, you know, I was feeling a lot of things. I was feeling anger and some resentment, and in the situation I was in, that would be totally inappropriate to voice. And so it built up. Mm-hmm. And then when you start talking about suicide, everyone swoops in. Mm-hmm. And it's all about you. And then as soon as it's clear that the immediate danger has passed, then, well, I'll, I should say that my wife called the county mental health, who came out to do an evaluation. And it was like, as soon as they sort of realized that, oh, well, you know, this isn't going to happen, you know, today or tomorrow.
Right.
So, and then they just disappeared.
Right.
And,
right. And you're alone, like, with okay, the feelings.
So all you're really concerned about with is keeping me alive.
Yes.
And what I needed was for someone to say, hey, what are you feeling? Mm-hmm. What's going on? And if someone had done that earlier, I wouldn't even have got to that point. And that's why I say with adolescents, you know, we tend to gloss over, how are you doing? Fine. There's always has to be that safe place to express your feelings.
Well, and I think even more so for men, Mark, and I keep thinking of shows I want to do and have men come in, because, you know, the highest suicide rate is middle-aged men, because they have the least output or release for these emotions and things we're feeling. Yeah. And what's interesting about men in our culture is that you can go through life being the tough guy and having all the answers and supporting your family. But when you hit midlife, you start looking back and saying, hey, there's more to me than a provider for others, that I have an emotional life. And when you start to tap into that emotional life and you've had no outlet for it all of your adult life, it's overwhelming. And where do you take those feelings? Because everyone says, but wait, you're the tough guy. You're the guy that looks out for us. Stop having these feelings.
Yeah. Well, I'm in my early 50s and an empty nester. Mm-hmm. And, you know, you get used to your life being a certain way. And then you don't have the kids there. Right. Looking up to you. You don't have this. You don't have that. And another thing, I think it was brought up by another caller, is how do you address someone, you know, in that very severe depression, mm-hmm. or suicidal? And what we tend to do is we say, the person says something like, you know, I don't feel like I have anything to live for. And immediately we argue with them. We say, oh, yes, you do. You've got your kids. You've got this. You've got that. You have. And it's like, I know that. What I'm trying to say is I want to tell you how I'm feeling. And it's very easy for people to slip into this, you know, contradictory argument to argue their case for you not to commit suicide. And that's the opposite of listening.
Exactly. And I think, I of course, I have to cut you off, which I don't want you to feel like I'm not listening, Mark. But
okay.
But I do want to say that what you bring up is so important, because how we treat men and women and children is unique to their developmental stage. And so we have a lot of work to do as therapists. We have a lot of work to do as educators about how do we talk to people. And when we lump depression and suicidal ideation into this idea that it's a mental illness, we take away the power of the person struggling to get better. We also take away the power of the family and friends to be able to help with them at that time. So I think that that's an important piece to address. And thank you for having the courage to call in and to talk about your story, because I know that that connects with a lot of people. And I want to leave you today with some ideas about what it takes to actually feel okay when you're in that dark space, even though it's so hard to imagine getting up another day. I want you to think about these four things that we need to have in our lives to help maintain our mental health and well-being. The first one is emotional connection, because when you're alone, even in the context of a family, a loving family, you can feel very alone. Being with others doesn't always equate to feeling connected or emotionally connected. Often we hide our true feelings and thoughts from those around us who love us most, because we don't want them to be afraid, or we don't want to seem unlovable. And when we hide our true nature, ourselves, we allow that shame of those feelings to get in our way of being close. So with emotional connection, it's more than just having people around us. We have to be able to show our ugly side if it feels ugly. And that's a lesson to those who love other people, that you can't only love others for what you find acceptable about them. You have to love them and embrace them, mind, body, and spirit, and warts and all, because we tend to unconsciously kind of reject those things we don't like about those around us. The other three things are physical connection and support. Reach out for support when you need it. This has been a conversation with a reluctant therapist. I hate hate having to rush at the end, but you can find more information on my Facebook page or send me an email to Elizabeth@thereluctanttherapist.com. Thank you for supporting Public Radio, KCBX.
Turns the whole thing around. No.